Thanks for joining us. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on a cruise with NPR listeners. Mention MI5 and many people will think of the espionage novels of John le Carré. But it was only recently that the real MI5 came out from the cloak of secrecy. To celebrate its centennial, the British Secret Service opened up its extensive archives to independent historian Christopher Andrew. His book, Defend the Realm, the authorised history of MI5, is based on those documents. Christopher Andrew is Britain's leading historian of intelligence and a professor at Cambridge University in Britain. He joins me in the studio. Christopher, it is a pleasure to have you here.
Katty, thank you for asking me.
We will be opening the phones. 1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. And of course, you can send those questions and comments by email as well to drshow@wamu.org. Christopher, you got a huge amount of access, unprecedented access to MI5's files. Why did they give it to you? What did you come across?
Well, I think that MI5 and British intelligence generally have been trying to catch up. I mean, they have been the world's, or at any rate, the Western world's most buttoned-up intelligence community till recently. I mean, the British government didn't even admit that it had a foreign intelligence service, MI6, until 1992.
Even though everybody knew it did.
Even though everybody knew it, and even though one of its fictional members was the most popular intelligence officer in world history, James Bond. And MI5 didn't even start releasing its files for the First World War until 1997. So it realised it needed to catch up, and I like to think that I have been the way of catching up.
You've taken 7 years.
Yes, on and off.
Tell us about the files that you went through. I mean, there must have been hundreds and hundreds of documents that you pored over.
Well, millions and millions, actually. What I was told at the beginning was that the British Security Service, MI5, has, stretching back over the last century, 400,000 files. But I failed to realise that, for example, so far as traitors from Cambridge University are concerned, I am from Cambridge University, but honestly, our people go into our site nowadays, that many of them were multi-volume. So Anthony Blunt, for example, and Kim Philby and the other famous Cambridge traitors, there are 50 volumes per person. So it's several million. So I had a lot to get through. So I had to prioritize. But going in the morning, and if the worst question you can ask yourself, what should it be today? A bit more of Anthony Blunt, or how about a bit of the IRA? You know, it's not an agonizing question.
And I should say, for our listeners who cannot see the book, of course, it is almost 1,000 pages long. I've started going through it, and it reads like a thriller itself, particularly those chapters on the Cambridge Five. And we'll get to more of those later, because I was riveted by the kinds of dealings that MI5 had and the way that they managed finally to put the pieces of that puzzle together. Why do you think, you've talked about the need to bring itself into the modern ages and to change its image and to open up to the world, but why now? What was it that particularly triggered this in the organisation to give you this kind of access to write this kind of history?
Well, I think it's been a gradual process, but I would sum it up by saying better late than never. The problem, you know, just over 30 years ago, the British were pretty buttoned up. And nobody talked in Parliament. It's almost impossible to imagine that 30 years ago, you couldn't even ask a question about MI5 or MI6 in Parliament. And the press were not terribly intrusive. But then, of course, things began to change in the 1980s. And MI5 realised that if you don't get information, you get disinformation. So there were best-selling histories by an MI5 renegade, for example, which sold far more copies in the United States than even this book, I fear, will, alleging that for 9 years, a head of MI5 had been working for the Soviet Union, alleging that MI5 had tried to bring down a British Prime Minister, Harold Wilson. So the only option to disinformation is information. And I think that idea gradually spread.
Give us a brief history of the organisation. It started at the beginning of the 20th century, really on a shoestring budget.
Well, the shoestring just shows what you can achieve with a very small number of motivated people. So on the eve of the Second World War, on the eve of the First World War, the entire British Security Service consisted of 17 people, and that included the caretaker. And yet these 17 people actually rounded up all the German spies who were worth rounding up on the eve of war, and there were 22 of them. I think that's probably the last time that 17 people have rounded up 22 people. And had they not been rounded up, the Kaiser's Germany would have known where British troops were going, and the difficult early months of the First World War would have been more difficult. And if you just fast forward to the present, it was found to deal with counter-espionage. Nowadays, MI5 spends 3.5% of its resources on counter-espionage. We're now counter-terrorist, and we are dealing with the biggest terrorist threat in the history of either the United Kingdom or the United States.
That's extraordinary that your 17 people, including the caretaker, we mustn't forget the caretaker, managed to round up all the spies that were worth having in Britain before the First World War. Does that suggest either that the spies, the German spies, were not particularly good at their job, that things have got a lot more sophisticated now? Because I can't believe that you could have that small an organisation with that level of success today.
Well, I don't think you could. And it is partly, of course, because the opposition's got more sophisticated. In these days, they used to write to each other, or rather the German intelligence used to write to them. And Winston Churchill, who has been absolutely critical to the success of British intelligence at many stages of his 50-year involvement with British intelligence, gave MI5 the right, after applying for a warrant to do so under law, to intercept people's correspondence. So it was by intercepting the correspondence of people from particular known German intelligence centres in Germany that we managed to track down all the German spies.
You're a professor of history. You specialise, of course, in intelligence, in military intelligence. Were there things that you discovered in those files, in those acres and acres of files, that surprised even you?
Lots and lots and lots and lots. But you mentioned James Bond a little while ago, so let me give you one example of that. I did discover, in the course of doing this, somebody who worked for MI5 who did things that even Bond didn't. Now, that sounds an exaggeration, but let me tell you. During the 1930s, MI5's most adventurous agent, who was called the Mad Major, and because he was a major and also he was a bit mad, flew under all the London bridges. And at this time, he was just regarded as an eccentric. And you could get away with an amazing number of things if you were an eccentric. Now, amongst the people who noticed him doing this was Adolf Hitler, who had just become leader of Germany. So he was summoned over to a German air show. The Führer talked to him, became absolutely fascinated with what he was doing, and he got asked to be an agent. And he agreed to be an agent, stopping only to ask MI5 if it was okay for him to be a German agent. So, absolutely fine. However, just keep us in touch with what you're up to and tell the Germans only what we tell you to say. And it was through that that MI5 learnt the control mechanisms that were used for real German agents in Britain. And that was why every single one was captured during the Second World War. All the best of them were turned down into the double cross system, which I think historians on both sides of the Atlantic accept was the most successful deception in the entire history of warfare. Just shows you where one James Bond can lead.
And Hitler had no inclination that this mad major, this eccentric who had flown under the bridges of London along the Thames, might be actually working for MI5. It didn't occur to him.
No, Hitler was a funny fellow, but part of him was a bit dim.
Well, I'm glad the mad major managed to sort out that ring of spies. Tell me about a little bit more about the double cross system. You mentioned it there, and your book has some of the weaknesses of MI5, but it also has some of their triumphs. And you say in the book that really the double cross system was one of the most significant achievements of the British Secret Services.
Yes. Well, let's go back to one of the most important dates in American as well as British history, and a good example of the special relationship at war. The 6th of June, 1944, the D-Day landings on the Normandy beaches in occupied France. Now, because it worked, Eisenhower's extraordinary gamble as Allied Supreme Commander in Europe in attempting an invasion. You know, people, I think, don't realise what it depended on. And it wouldn't have worked because there were far more German forces on the continent than the US and British forces could hope to land in the first week in a bridgehead. So it was only by persuading the Germans that, look, this is just a sideshow. The real attack is going to come in the area around Calais, which is the area of France which is nearest to Britain, that it was able to succeed. Once he got disinformation from the double agents who he thought were German agents but actually were working for MI5, Hitler stops in his track. The 1st SS Panzer Division, one of the crack forces that was headed to deal with real invasion, and pulls it back to deal with an invasion that never happens. The double agent who was most responsible for this, who was our biggest star, and therefore called Garbo, who was a big star at the time, was awarded the Iron Cross by Hitler himself.
So presumably those double agents were also having to send a certain amount of real information to Germany. It had to be a fairly sophisticated process to keep the Germans believing that they were still working for Berlin.
Absolutely. And that was the success of the system. Disinformation only works if you mix in with it enough information to be really attractive to the person you're attempting to deceive. And because we were also breaking German codes, it meant that we could check what they were really falling for, anything they might become a little bit sceptical about. So we were always able to tell the Germans what they thought they wanted to hear.
What was the relationship between MI5 and the British government before the Second World War?
Before the Second World War, MI5 found it pretty difficult to get through to a pretty intellectually challenged British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, that actually appeasing Hitler, trying to be nice to him, was not a way of stopping him launching the Second World War, but actually was more likely to make him likely to do it. So in the end, it fell back on telling truth to power in a way that I think no intelligence agency in the world had done to that point. If you're finding it really difficult to get through to policymaking, telling that policymaker that his or her leading opponent is insulting him, you'll always get the attention of the policymaker. So excuse this language, but it does appear in the files. Vernon Kell, by that time elderly head of MI5, decided the only way to get through to the British Prime Minister was to tell him that Adolf Hitler regularly referred to him as an arsehole, and he did get his attention.
Christopher Andrew is the author of The Authorised History of MI5. The book is called Defend the Realm. He joins me in the studio for the hour to talk about the history of British secret services. The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. You can send your questions and comments by email. drshow@wmu.org is the address. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm joined in the studio by Christopher Andrew. His new book is Defend the Realm, The Authorised History of MI5. We were talking about the relationship between MI5 and the government in the run-up to the Second World War. I've got an email here from a listener who writes in, does the book discuss the anti-Jewish policy and activities of MI5 during the Second World War, as discussed in the B. Wasserstein book, Britain and the Jews of Europe? Does the book you are discussing go into how MI5 was directly responsible for the deaths of several hundred Jews trying to escape the Holocaust? Christopher.
What it does go into is the MI5's response to extremist Zionist terrorism, and it did not behave well, and I've described frankly how it did not behave well. But it is worth remembering that the great majority of British Zionists were opposed to the use of terrorism to get the Brits out of the Palestine mandate rather more quickly than they would have gone otherwise. So, you know, what were the methods used by Menachem Begin, by the Irgun, by the Stern Gang? Well, to blow up the headquarters of the British Mandate in Palestine, the King David Hotel, then halfway to Britain to blow up the British Embassy in Rome. And then what tends to get forgotten is to attempt to blow up an equally big explosion in Whitehall. And all the details, and the woman who planted the bomb, there was a picture of her in the book. Now, The great majority of British Zionists were opposed to all this, and indeed they informed on the extremists. What I think is just about unforgivable, however, is that MI5, for the next 20 years and more, refused to recruit Jews because it believed that there was a dual loyalty. I think that is entirely wrong, but I've been entirely frank about, I think, one of the most deplorable episodes in MI5 history.
And indeed, in 1955, one section head of the MI5 was quoted as saying, "Our policy is to avoid recruiting Jews if possible."
That's right. And I've quoted that in the book, and I've quoted later things as well. It needs to be remembered, however, that when one's talking about immigration into the future state of Israel, that was not something under the control of MI5. But I have been entirely frank about the level of anti-Semitism that existed in MI5.
You stop the book in the 21st century. You're dealing only with the last century. Why did you stop... Why did you not quote
does,
archives from this century?
No, it does come up to the 21st century. It necessarily has to be a rather smaller in detail, because revealing exactly what MI5 was up to against the IRA, now that there is no longer a war by the IRA against the British government in London is one thing. Dealing with a continuing struggle is another thing. But I've given quite a few details, and the book contains surveillance photographs published for the first time of, for example, and I think most Americans, like most Brits, don't know that the first major al-Qaeda attack against Britain or the United States actually occurred in Britain, and it was stopped in the year 2000. It may not be well known that the British 9/11 was stopped much more recently. The trial concluded only a couple of months ago, in September of this year, of a plot by Islamist suicide bombers to board 7 aircraft leaving Heathrow during a 3-hour period for North America, each of which would have exploded using very sophisticated, because they were very simple bombs. I mean, these were the ones that were going to be concealed inside soft drinks bottles and were going to use as the detonators things you could buy in any airport, in other words, the flash mechanism. So there would have been, a few years ago, a British 9/11, had it not been successfully stopped by the kind of surveillance which is described in the book and of which there are some photographs.
Was there ever a point during your research or your writing of the book where MI5 came to you and said, for national security reasons, you can't say that, you can't have access to these papers, or you can't publish these papers?
Not so far as access is concerned. For the 20th century, I had unlimited access. I thought for the 21st century, it was simply not right for me to ask for access to files on cases which had still to come to court or still to receive, in which a judgment had not been given. But so far as the 20th century was concerned, I was absolutely determined that no conclusion I arrive at in the book should be falsified by files that I shouldn't quote. So I spent just as much time looking at files whose contents can't be released as files whose contents can be released to make sure that what I say is a fair conclusion in the light of all the files, not just the ones that can be released.
Let's talk a little bit about the shift from fighting Germany during the Second World War to taking on the Soviet Union after the Second World War. What did that demand in terms of the MI5, the kind of refocusing that it needed to do?
Well, the problem was twofold. One is that Soviet spies in Britain, as indeed in the United States, were of a considerably higher caliber. And secondly, they were ideologically committed. And this is one thing that Islamist terrorists have in common with Soviet spies in Britain and the United States. They were absolutely committed. Secondly, they had got in place before MI5, or for that matter, the FBI seriously attempted to track them down. And this was why, for example, the plans of the first atomic bomb were able to be given by Soviet agents from Los Alamos to Soviet intelligence. So that was one problem. The other problem was that the Soviet Union...
Was that because we were still focused on fascism and the legacy of the Second World War, that it took us a while and that we'd seen the Soviets our allies, it just took us a while to reshift our focus and to realise just how big a threat this was?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was, after all, the most successful period for Soviet espionage in both the United States and Britain was while we were wartime allies. And Britain, for example, didn't even intercept Soviet communications during the Second World War. The United States did. It didn't make any serious attempt to crack the codes. But really, the beginnings of the discovery of what had been going on, in particular the discovery of the atom spies, who gave away the single biggest secret that's ever been given away by a spy at any point in human history. This was a result of the fact that after the Second World War, the Americans, having intercepted the communications, then set about with their British allies to attempt to crack them. If we hadn't been allies, then I think the Soviet spies would have got far less successfully than they did.
How long did it take Washington and London to cotton on to that weakness?
Well, it took rather longer for the Brits because we had not been intercepting the messages. So the first spies who were caught, even though in most cases, because it depended on code breaking, you couldn't in those days and be difficult now to use that kind of evidence in court, were never tried. But in Britain, because we didn't have the evidence, it took us far longer to sew up these cases than it did in the case of the United States.
Let's get on to one of the most famous periods of history in MI5, and something, of course, everyone here knows about as well as back in Britain. That was the infiltration of MI5 by the group known as the Cambridge Five. I read the chapter on it last night. It was gripping to see how they managed to find out exactly who was in the organisation, how long it took them to find out who were the five members of this group. Tell us a little bit about that period.
Well, these were exceptionally capable people. That's the first point. Then secondly, MI5 made a number of bungles in attempting to track them down. That was the second point. But the KGB always thought that the ablest group of foreign agents that it ever recruited were five young graduates from Cambridge University in the mid-1930s. And they all managed to penetrate the corridors of power, including at different times all the three major intelligence agencies. When I think the biggest box office success in the history of Westerns, The Magnificent Seven, came out in 1960, KGB loved Westerns. They started calling the five the Magnificent Five, and so they were.
And not all of them, of course, then defected to Moscow. Some of them stayed in Britain and lived under the radar for a fairly long time.
Absolutely.
Not even under the radar, in the corridors of power still.
Well, one of them, the three, Burgess, MacLean and Philby, defected to Moscow. Another one, the fifth man, John Cairncross, the only one, by the way, to infiltrate British codebreakers during the Second World War, lived abroad. But the one that remained in Britain was another historian who worked for MI5. This was Anthony Blunt. And a number of times when I've gone into MI5, I've thought to myself, I'm not the first reasonably well-known Cambridge historian to work for MI5. Anthony Blunt was there ahead of me. But when he began to be interrogated, MI5 took, unintentionally, a terrible revenge on him. He was interrogated by Peter Wright, who subsequently became a renegade and was a conspiracy theorist. And he spent years and years trying to get Anthony Blunt to admit to doing things that he hadn't. Now, Anthony Blunt liked a gin or tonic or three some time. But the telephone taps reveal that by 1970, his drink bill was £100 a month. Now, that may not sound a lot, but I was a young academic in Cambridge at the time, and my annual salary was £1,000 a year. So Blunt was spending more in drink after being interrogated by MI5 in 1970 than I was getting in my entire salary.
How did MI5, they were spying for two or three decades, the Cambridge Five. How did MI5 rumble them? How did they realise that, first of all, they had these agents in their midst, and then who they were?
Well, fortunately, even though Soviet communications, KGB communications, weren't intercepted during the Second World War in Britain, they were in the United States. And Donald MacLean had been posted to the British Embassy in the United States at the end of the Second World War. So by 1951, it was clear that Agent Homer was actually Donald MacLean. And it was through discovering Donald MacLean that he gradually opened up to all the others. When he defected to Russia, the Russians told Guy Burgess, who had also been stationed a little bit later in Washington, to go with him. Now, Burgess was a close friend of Philby. That began to put Philby under suspicion. And during the Second World War, Burgess had shared a flat with Anthony Blunt. And so the Soviet tradecraft in the 1930s was not always to tell each of its agents, don't have anything to do with any other agent. Because all the five knew each other, it was through tracking down the first ones, which eventually, a lot later than it should have done, led to all of them being tracked down.
And after that period, the MI5 really became obsessed with having spies in its midst. I mean, this is where it gets into the John le Carré period and yes. Smiley's people and trying yeah. to root out the spies in its midst.
Well, most of it didn't. But the almost the worst thing that... And there are two really terrible things that can happen to an intelligence service. One is to have a traitor, and the other is to have a conspiracy theorist who suspects everybody. Now, in the end, there were just one or two conspiracy theorists and Peter Wright, who, because he got his book banned by Her Majesty's government, sold 900,000 copies in the United States. Unless I can get my book banned by Her Majesty's government, even though it's doing reasonably well, I don't think I'm going to sell that much. So, it created a climate of distrust. For example, for a British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, to have to tell the young President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, that a former deputy head of MI5, Graham Mitchell, was being investigated on a charge of being a Soviet spy. Why did he have to tell them that? Because if he had been, he would have passed on American secrets as well. That was a really humiliating moment. So I think that before anybody joins any intelligence agency, they should be tested for conspiracy theory.
And there was a really tricky period between US and British intelligence relations after the discovery of the Cambridge Five. And these relations were not good between the two organizations.
They weren't. And it was at the beginning of it, J. Edgar Hoover could be a pretty difficult person to deal with, as many of his colleagues would attest us. So what we had to do, so far as he was concerned, was to make him a knight. And I think that not many people realize that he was, in fact, Sir J. Edgar Hoover, even though, of course, as an American citizen, he couldn't use the title. But he was formally presented at the beginning of the 1950s, after the discovery of the British atom spies, with a knighthood, and that calmed him down a bit.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. We are going to go to the phones now to Bob in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Bob, you've joined The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. My question involves the Cambridge Five, Philby, McLean, Burgess, and Blunt. During the Korean War, these three of them, at least, were attached to the British Embassy here on Massachusetts Avenue. And there were reports that the military dispatches coming from General MacArthur in Korea had been passed on by them to Stalin and then to the Communist Chinese, so that when the Chinese intervened in that war, they knew exactly where all the U.S. forces were, and therefore they had, in a sense, helped to engineer this defeat. Now, you mentioned the atomic side. McLean, I guess, is the one who would have stolen the U.S. atomic secrets and given it to the Soviets. And just in the general background, the fact that they were tolerated so long, the fact that Blunt was never arrested, doesn't this indicate that these people were, in fact, British triple agents carrying out a project of balancing the superpowers, which was officially approved, at least by the establishment and the city?
Bob, I think you should be writing spy novels yourself, Christopher Andrew.
Bob, I think you should be writing spy novels as well. But my take on it is the same as yours for part of what you said, and a little bit different when it comes to triple agents. There are not many of those around. Those who were in a position to talk about U.S. Policy as well as British policy at the beginning of the Korean War were Philby, who was the SIS MI6 representative in Washington from 1949 to 1951, and therefore at the beginning of the Korean War. Burgess was a more junior diplomat, but he could have added a little bit. McLean was the head of the American desk in the British Foreign Office. But Burgess and McLean flee in 1951. That brings the intelligence they're able to provide to an end. So far as Philby is concerned, even though there is no usable evidence against him, the Americans are quite rightly suspicious of him. So he's withdrawn from Washington and ceases full-time employment with SIS. So far as Blunt, I mean, if in your novel or in your book, Bob, you go on to present Blunt as a triple agent, I think the problem is going to be all the attempts that are made to get Blunt to admit and what he'd done. And that these attempts continue for 10 years. And in the end, the reason that he wasn't prosecuted was simply that even though there was all kinds of evidence against him, it was not usable evidence. And unless he was willing to confess, as, for example, Klaus Fuchs did, with the most important of the atom spies, without realizing that the evidence that obtained from code breaking couldn't be used against him. So I think the Blunt theory that he was a triple agent used by the Brits as well as by the Russians, but with his first loyalty to the Brits, falls in the light of the files that I've seen and the files that I've quoted about the really determined attempts to get him to confess. And it was only after a decade of this that, and he wasn't acquiring new intelligence in the meantime, it was only after a decade of failure that it was decided to say, okay, tell us all you know and we won't prosecute you.
And, of course, in that tricky world of spying and counter-spying, the issue of usable evidence is a very current one as well. Christopher Andrew is the author of Defend the Realm, the Authorised History of MI5. You can join our conversation after this short break. The number is 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. After this short break, we'll be taking more of your calls with your questions and comments. Do stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed at aecf.org. By the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Gruber Family Foundation, to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
With medical advances in the military, more soldiers are surviving on the battlefield but coming home missing limbs. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Paul Pasquina, chief of orthopedics and rehabilitation at Walter Reed Hospital, as well as Paul Cunningham, a biomedical engineer who returned from duty in Iraq missing part of his arm. He wears and designs prosthetics. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. I'm joined here in the studio by Christopher Andrew. His new book is Defend the Realm. It is the authorised history of MI5. Much of the time during the 1980s and the early 1990s, of course, MI5 switched then from being focused on the Soviet threat and had to focus a lot on the IRA. We have an email who has come in here from Charles McGeehee in Ellensburg, Washington, who writes to us, it was said that during the recent war in Northern Ireland that the British used what was euphemistically called deep interrogation. Do you know anything about this?
MI5 didn't use deep interrogation. There have been, and it's a euphemism, of course, for the kind of interrogation that should not take place. There are a number of official reports on the interrogation that was used. MI5, for the first time in its history, and this is without any presumption of guilt, was earlier this year, what it knew about someone who's alleged of giving aid and assistance to Islamist terrorism, only accused, it has yet to be demonstrated, Binyam Mohammed, The papers on that, whether MI5 knew that he was being tortured by the intelligence agencies of other countries, that has been referred for police investigation for the first time in MI5's history. So I think that the report that comes out on that should take us a good deal further. What I do know from the files is that, and these are files written by people who never supposed for one moment that what they wrote would ever become public, that the traditional MI5 view has been, look, don't torture people for two reasons. One, it is in fact wrong. But then secondly, if you torture somebody, they will say exactly what it is that you want them to say. So it's actually a bad way of discovering what they actually did.
Talking more of the IRA, you write at one point in the book, Christopher, that the IRA came close to winning the war in Northern Ireland. When was that?
The point at which the IRA came close to some kind of success, which would have done terrible damage to the British economy, was in the 1990s. In the 1990s, their strategy, and if they'd tried it earlier, it might have worked. In the 1990s, they decided that they would try to destroy a whole series of major financial buildings in the City of London, which at that point, as now, was Europe's, if not the world's, anyway, Europe's leading financial centre. But in each of the bombing campaigns, they only managed to destroy one building. The same time, they were sending letters to foreign financial institutions saying, you know, do you want to be destroyed? Or wouldn't you sooner relocate? So I think they came quite close to destroying the City of London. Why didn't they do so? Well, it tends not to be realized that MI5 didn't get the lead intelligence role against IRA attacks on the British mainland until 1992. I think it got it just in time to save the City of London.
Let's go to Tim in Boca Raton, Florida. Tim, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Yes, thank you. And a very interesting topic.
Thank you for joining the program.
Thank you. My question is, in 1953, the United States and Britain overthrew Iran's government. And I know in America's case, it was the CIA that played a part in it. What role did MI5 play in this one?
Thank you, Tim. This was not an MI5 role because MI5 is a domestic security service, although nowadays it has responsible for counterterrorism around the world. This was MI6. MI6 actually thought of the idea even before the CIA. It was a classic example, I think, of a short-term success that was a long-term failure. It helped, actually, it was the Iranian army to overthrow Mossadegh, the supposedly anti-Western, actually anti-Western, but not, I think, all that pro-communist as believed at the time, leader of Iran, and reinstate the Shah. Now, one of the reasons why so many people in Iran are still so suspicious of the United States and Britain is the coup in 1953. We're not attempting to mount coups now, but of course they insist that we are. No, it was a terrible blunder, no question about that.
Christopher, at what point did MI5 start to see that Islamic terrorism was a serious threat? Because as far as I understand it, as late as 1996, Dame Stella Rimington, who was, of course, head of MI5, had never even heard the name Al-Qaeda.
That is absolutely right. Stella Rimington, who was on her last trip to the United States in 1996 before she retired, first heard the phrase Al-Qaeda during her final intelligence discussions in Washington. I think the mistake that was made by MI5 and by the whole of Whitehall and by most Western governments was failure to take a long view. And this was the case in which there were a number of academics, not many, but the great hero of them all is currently professor at Georgetown in Washington, Bruce Hoffman. He took the long view. He predicted in the mid-1990s that the problem for the early 21st century was going to be holy terror. I got it right as well, but that was only because I realized that Bruce got it right. But of course, you know, because we separate the secular and the sacred in Western culture in a way that some other cultures do not, what we should have done was to get in a lot of theologians. You know, so we understood Islamist terrorism far worse than we had understood Nazism, because, of course, that's a secular ideology. So we got in people who understood the ideology, understood them far less well than Marxism, Leninism, so that's a secular ideology. So the big failure was, I think, not enough theologians. I hope we put that right now.
And would you say that was true, Christopher? I mean, that's a fascinating point. Would you say that was true of American and British secret services, that we just didn't understand religious motivated terrorism in the way that we did ideological, secular ideology-motivated attacks?
Oh, absolutely. Even devout people in their private lives make a real distinction between their private beliefs and public policy. But it is, after all, the case that Jesus was crucified by a state and Muhammad founded a state. There have been basic Western misunderstandings about Islam. I had the enormous privilege with Pakistani friends to go in the days when you could, from top to bottom, side to side of Pakistan, went to the Swat Valley where nobody would venture. Now, wonderful, peaceful place. I mean, talking to some of the most hospitable people on earth, and I'm not exaggerating, the Pakistani people, you know, one could understand, however, the way that you could not understand them if you sought to separate their political beliefs from their religious beliefs. And that simple proposition, I think, was too difficult for most people in Whitehall and Washington to grasp.
Let's go to Mark in Silver Lake, Ohio. Mark, thanks for your patience. You've joined the program.
Oh, this is a wonderful program, and I can't begin to tell you how anxious I am to read your guest's book. I'm calling about the bombing of the King David Hotel. It's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that the British headquarters in the hotel had actually received warnings. Menachem Begin, I read somewhere, claimed that three telephone calls were placed, one to the hotel, another to the French consulate, and a third one to the Palestine Post. And that, although the British had been denying for decades that they had been warned, sometime in 1978 or 79, a member of Parliament actually introduced evidence that the Irgun had indeed issued a warning before the bombing. Can Mr. Andrew confirm or deny this?
I think that what actually happened, Mark, was that Menachem Begin, this is a deeply controversial area, and I fully accept the fact that people can interpret the evidence of in more than one way, didn't give proper warning, were embarrassed afterwards, and gave a slightly misleading account of the kind of warning they'd given. Let me give you some confirmation of that. It has never, ever been suggested that Menachem Begin or Irgun or the Stern Gang, and by the way, the Stern Gang was the last terrorist group in the world to actually call itself a terrorist, gave any advance warning of the attempt to blow up one of the Whitehall ministries in the centre of London in 1948. Now, had they done so, there would have been loss of life on the same scale as there was in Jerusalem. The only reason that it didn't work is that Betty Knut, her picture is in the book, and the details are in the book, failed to fuse the bomb correctly. So if they were the motive had really been to avoid loss of life, why was no warning given in 1948 in the centre of London? Why was it never suggested that any warning was given? I think we should take the Begin version with a pinch of salt. But I fully understand that different people can read the same evidence in different ways.
Let's go to Barbara in Toledo, Ohio. Barbara, you have a question about the BBC series, and we have several emails that have come in about this and callers asking about this series and whether it is an accurate portrayal. Do go ahead and put your question to Christopher Andrew.
Well, I've always been a huge fan of the series Ace of Spies, Sidney Reilly, Ace of Spies. What was his role in Russia before, during, and after the Russian Revolution in 1918, and was he involved earlier in gaining the oil monopoly for Britain in the Middle East?
Well, it's difficult, Barbara, to think of a more colourful spy than Sidney Reilly. The problem was that he was a fantasist as well, so deconstructing his career, working out the things that he really did do and the things that he simply fantasised about is really pretty difficult. I don't think he got the oil monopoly. He was immensely courageous. The idea that he had, it may sound a bit silly, but at any rate it was an idea, was that after the Russian Revolution he would parade without their trousers, both Lenin and Trotsky, through the streets of Moscow, and this would discredit them in a way which would mean that the local population took no account of them. Now, I think that idea gives you kind of the measure of the man. At operationally, he was extremely brave, but he had some pretty wild and tacky ideas, and that was a pretty wild and tacky idea.
We have an email here, Christopher, from Mark Zaid. Oh, from Washington, D.C. Mark, hello. Who asks, what, if anything, surprising or interesting did Mr. Andrew find concerning the relationship between MI5 and the United States? And was there any investigation undertaken by MI5 concerning President Kennedy's assassination?
I think that what most struck me about the relations between MI5 and the United States is of the U.S. intelligence community has been just how close it has been. I've already mentioned that, and I think few Americans know this, that J. Edgar Hoover, who hung around rather too long, perhaps, as director of the FBI, but nonetheless MI5 had to deal with him, he was awarded an honorary British knighthood. Moving towards the end of the Cold War, after the end of the Cold War, I think one of the things, and it is described in the book, that struck me most, that the first aircraft that was allowed into U.S. airspace on the day after 9/11 and with a fighter escort landed at Andrews Air Force Base, had three people on board. One was the head of SIS, MI6, a foreign intelligence agency. The other was the deputy head of MI5, Eliza Manningham Buller, now Baroness Manningham Buller. The reason that he was the deputy is that the head of MI5 had to remain in London to brief Blair. And the third one was the head of our code-breaking organization, GCHQ, the equivalent of NSA. Now, I don't think you could have a much more extraordinary example of the closeness of the relationship between the two intelligence communities than that extraordinary air flight. And no sooner had they landed that they were whisked off to Langley for round-the-clock talks and so on and so on.
And I'm sure that wasn't known at the time.
It wasn't known at the time.
Let's go to Chris in Rockville, Maryland. Chris, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, I was at Los Alamos during the atomic development period as a very junior scientist, and I have since learned that apparently the one who provided most of the information to the Russians about the atomic bomb before the first atomic bomb test was generally known to the world was a person at Harvard and then at Los Alamos who was a very gifted physicist, and he was never detected, and he provided information on the theory. He provided information to the Russians on the rather interesting theory that it would be a bad thing if, after the war was over, only one country had a nuclear monopoly. So he proceeded with his inside knowledge as a very gifted scientist working at Los Alamos. He provided the information that the Russians needed and that Stalin showed up with in early 1945 to Truman's surprise. And he has not been widely recognized. He is now dead, and as I understand it, his widow was still living in Cambridge, England, where he and his wife had decided that they had better emigrate to for their own personal safety.
Okay, Christopher Andrew, a glimpse there in the history.
She lives in the next street to me in Cambridge. His name was Ted Hall. I interviewed him on the BBC. He was the youngest major spy of the 20th century. He was given the Russian code name Mlad, which means youngster. He went up to Harvard as a physics major at the age of 15. He graduated summa cum laude in 1944. And he went off to Los Alamos, not to make the tea, but to work on the implosion principle, a word which didn't exist in the Russian language at that point. I've interviewed him, both him on the BBC and also the FBI interrogator. He was interrogated at exactly the same time as the Rosenberg trial. The reason that he was never prosecuted is that the only evidence available from him came from code breaking. Whereas, so far as the Rosenbergs were concerned, there was collateral. Greenglass was able to give evidence against them. But you've rightly pointed out one of the most extraordinary espionage stories in the entire history of espionage. Now, Cambridge is an extraordinary place. You get to meet people from both sides.
Christopher, before we go, we've got a couple of minutes left on the programme. We're getting a lot of emails asking about the BBC series MI5, or Spooks, of course, and how realistic is it?
Well, as I understand it, because spooks carries unfortunate connotations on this side of the Atlantic that it doesn't on the other side of the Atlantic, it's actually called MI5 on this side of the Atlantic. The most realistic thing about it is the picture that they show of the front entrance. I'm the only person who has actually been photographed, legally photographed, going in the front entrance. It's a lot of fun. I think the thing that is most realistic is that the three young people in it do look to me pretty much like the kind of people that I meet. But broadly speaking, the idea that you can solve any problem in 50 minutes, and secondly, you might kill somebody along the way. No, those two things don't happen.
And very briefly, my favourite email, which comes in from Steve. We have a couple of seconds left. Is there a real department that creates all those fabulous cars, trick items, etc.?
Yes.
And I hope that you know where it is. Christopher Andrew is the author of Defend the Realm. He's a professor of modern contemporary history at Cambridge University. His new book is The Authorised History of MI5. Christopher, thank you so much. It's been a fascinating hour. The book is 1,000 pages long and it's worth every page. You've had amazing access, and we've had, judging by the calls and questions we've had, a lot of people are going to be fascinated by what you've discovered. Thank you so much for joining the programme.
Thank you, Cathy. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.